Welcome to another edition of Always Right with Rochelle, the Right Now Coach. Today I'm delighted to be talking with Liam Callanan, the author of two novels, All Saints and the Cloud Atlas, and the director of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Welcome, Liam.
Hey, thanks very much.
Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about your newest book, All Saints?
My newest book, All Saints. And you're also able to hear my newest child, perhaps, in the world, which is a lovely 2.5-month-year-old named Jane.
Oh, cool.
Yes, she arrived. If people always ask how you kind of write and parent at the same time, and I have to admit, I'm really not sure either how the book or baby came to be simultaneously in the last year, but somehow it seems to have worked out. But
cool.
The book was born in Washington, D.C., but it takes place in Los Angeles or south of Los Angeles in a co-ed Catholic high school, and it's narrated by a 50-year-old woman who teaches theology there.
Wow.
She's a little bit unconventional. She's 3 times divorced and has a fairly irreverent attitude towards her subject and her students, and over the course of a single year, she gets into all kinds of trouble. But when sometimes someone mentioned it's like the Scarlet Letter meets the OC, I'm not quite sure. But I actually think, even though it sounds rather highfalutin to say, it's a book about faith and what it means to believe, which I think actually both of my books are at this point, both about Atlas and All Saints.
Well, that's neat. Thank you. Well, tell me how you got started as a novelist.
I got started as a novelist, I think, the way most people get started, which is I started as a reader. And as a outgrowth of that, it was something that I just really wanted to pursue. And when I left college, or when I graduated from college, I did not have a job, and I think I had half a mind that a novelist was a job, but then I sat down. I moved to Washington, D.C., because I could live there rent-free with some relatives, including them, my uncle, who had worked as a union carpenter for going on 40 years now, and he asked what I was going to do, and I said, well, I think I'm going to write, and he said, but you're going to get a job, aren't you? And so the next day, I went down to the temp agency, and basically I didn't look up for about a dozen years. That first temp job led into a variety of jobs in public relations and advertising and marketing, and at the very end I was doing speech writing for MCI, and after they went through a big merger, I decided that it would be a good time to have my midlife crisis or have it ahead of schedule, or, in other words, quit and write the great American novel then.
Wow.
And so that's what I did. So I parachuted out, and then I used my almost like a GI Bill, but in other words, my exit payment from MCI, used that to help me with graduate school, and I got an MFA at George Mason University. I wrote a dissertation as part of my thesis work there, and that's actually what became my first book, The Cloud Atlas, which is what got published.
Wow. Well, so how did being a speechwriter prepare you to be a novelist? They seem kind of different. Although both might be fiction. Let's hope not.
Right. Well, I used to joke that I worked in fiction every day when I was a speechwriter. But then, of course, given MCI's troubles, it turned out not to be so funny in the end. But I think, actually, at the time, I thought it was when I was working as a speechwriter and I was trying to write at night, it was very frustrating because I really didn't see a connection except for the fact that I was using, you know, the same keyboard, the same letters. It seemed like it was tapping two completely different parts of my brain and also wearing me down all the same. But the more I think about it, the more I think actually that it was great preparation, because the speechwriter course is all about trying to put words in someone else's mouth and trying to make that other person, when he or she delivers those words, sound like, you know, that they're words that they wrote or believe in themselves. And to me, that's actually a lot of what novel writing is all about, that you are trying to invest yourselves in these characters and these fictions that you've created, but you don't want them to stand out as fictions. You want them to be as real as the person reading the book or the person sitting next to them. And so I think in some ways that act of speech writing, of kind of dreaming up lives and voices and words for someone else, is actually a lot of what goes into the writing of a novel. And you know, in some ways, professionally, it helped as well, because as a speechwriter, I had to get rid of a lot of ego at the very beginning and just, you know, accept change and criticism from all sources. And I think in the novel drafting process, too, that working with an editor and an agent, both of whom I like very much, I was very ready and eager to accept their idea, so much so that sometimes they would joke and say, like, you really need to get in touch with your inner diva. You know? We're not really used to dealing with people who actually go ahead and make the changes that we ask for.
Wow.
So maybe there's a happy medium. But I think everybody has their own path to a book, and I've decided to do my own revisionist history on this one and say, yes, this is the way that we should do it now.
And it works perfectly.
Right. I mean, you could also go drive an ambulance in World War I Europe, maybe. That's launched a career, too, as well. But for us lesser souls, we settle for speech writing.
So you mentioned you have a baby and writing with children. I'm curious about the various ways you've gotten your books written and what works best for you in the writing process, especially being a parent. And I know you also have a faculty position now. So how do you do it?
Boy, you know what? I'm going to listen to this podcast and hear what I have to say, because I'm not even sure myself sometimes from day to day. What does work for me is giving up on the idea that I need total quiet and total isolation, and that I can only write under ideal conditions, because I think I've realized that there will never be ideal conditions. And for that matter, if I ever do approach the ideal conditions, I'll probably just go stir crazy from lack of distraction. But what I do is I grab an hour whenever I can. And sometimes I move from the write every day ethos to more of a write every week thing. Because, you know, if someone's throwing up on you at 3 o'clock in the morning, that's just not going to be a good writing day later. unless you have any writing about vomit that day, and then it's all to the good. But when I do write, I try, my way of trying to buy some isolation is that whenever, you know, all of our various care strategies align and the children are in school or otherwise taken care of, I sometimes decamp to the venerable coffee shop, which I like because, as I've said it often before, it definitely was the case with the Cloud Atlas and All Saints. I've always thought that when you get to a coffee shop, or at least when I get to a coffee shop, I'm always so afraid that someone's going to steal my laptop that I never get out of my chair, and that really is the secret to writing, which is just staying in the chair. And so that's and of course coffee helps. I mean, this is a little adrenaline to keep you going. I mean, one of the problems, frankly, with having moved to Milwaukee is I find it such a warm and friendly city that I'm not as nervous as I used to be about leaving my laptop when I run to the restroom. But that's all right. I'll figure out a way to kind of, maybe I'll write on the street or something like that.
Right on the bus.
Yeah, there we are.
So now you had gone to a writer's residency this summer. How does that kind of work differently than your regular day-to-day writing?
It worked very differently. I have to admit I was in just a stone-cold panic before I went there, because I realized suddenly that I was going to have this supposedly wonderful total isolation. It was the Eastern Frontier Foundation's Norton Island Residency, and it's way up the coast, or down the coast of Maine, down east, and it's on a little island, and you have, so you're about a mile from shore, too far to swim, it was pointed out to us, and everyone got their own little cabin, and the cabin was really just equipped with electricity, plus a bed and a desk, and
wow.
So for anything else that you wanted, like a cup of coffee or to take a shower, you had to kind of hike back to the main house. And at first that seemed like this was going to be a little bit awkward, but it turned out to be really wonderful. Once I just kind of, again, kind of got over the fact that it really was just me and the laptop staring at each other for a moment, once I realized I could really kind of use that silence and isolation and get used to it again. I mean, I can't remember really the last time I've been that isolated, you know, in my entire life for that matter. Camping trips as a kid when I was on a hike or something. But other than that, so once I'd adjusted to that, I found it wonderfully productive. And I really did. I made sure I didn't listen to the radio. They had internet access back at the main house. I got a special email address that I just gave to my wife. And so I limited my email just to that one account, which was, you know, just, hi, how are the kids doing? I'm sorry I'm not there, and I'll keep writing. So kind of like guilt mail account, and then back to the house again. So I was writing for vast stretches, and I got more done in whatever it was, 18 days there than I got done months here. So
wow.
There is something to be said for getting away every so often, but at the same time, it's a very, very intense experience I found writing like that, and I don't think it's something that I could do, you know, every day of the year, because I think I really would start to go crazy. And an important part of it was that there were other people in their own little cabins, and we would come together at night and talk, and that sense of community was very important for me there. And it's always, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I teach, actually. I'm very interested in writing as a builder of communities and how you can access those communities.
Wow. And do you find, I mean, I find that the work I do with people in public really feeds the writing. I don't think I could write if I didn't have people to talk to. Do you find that your writing teaching kind of inspires your writing or not?
Maybe. It's not a direct result. I don't really, or at least I haven't written yet so much about a writing teacher or something. I think it doesn't necessarily inform my work, but it definitely inspires it. Because it's really, for all the hard aspects of teaching, and it really is. I mean, Stephen King, no less an authority than he, who taught, I think, junior high or high school. Years ago, I once saw a quote that he said, teaching is like hooking jumper cables up to your head. And I've always liked that quote because it really is very draining. But at the same time, at least the teaching that I do and the students that I work with is very inspiring, because it's wonderful to surround yourself with people who really think that writing, that reading, the literature, that the community of letters is an important thing, so important that they want to spend hours on end in the classroom parsing out words and things. And so that is wonderful when I sit down to my own work to just kind of come fresh out of such a milieu. And I think that's the rewards of teaching for me there.
Well, I'm wondering what preparation you do to write your books. I heard Gail Godwin say that she has, like, basically a file box of files by the time she starts writing. So what do you do? What kind of research? What kind of thinking?
I look at Gail's files. No, I think it would be – I do. Actually, I have a file of clippings too, but it's in the basement, and I'm not exactly sure where it is right now. What I realized, one of the reasons I think that I was so productive up in Maine when I was there this summer is that I had been, without even necessarily really realizing it, pre-writing for almost the entire school year this book that I worked on this summer. And so I think that I liken it a lot to the metaphor that I use is of a computer, which at least on my computer or Windows computer has all those little programs that run in the background in the lower right corner. And I just think that for me, at least, when I'm working on a book, that it's always running there in the background, which, just like my computer, I think does dampen the performance of my overall brain functioning. But the more novels I start, the slower things happen.
Yeah.
If I can find my own Control-Alt-Delete key, I'll be a lucky man. But in any case, I was writing over the course of the school year, but I never had those extended stretches. But I think between writing and thinking about it all the time, I had really worked out much more of it than I thought. And I've heard other writers talk about this too. Like Toni Morrison talks about how when she actually sits down to physically write, it takes her a very short amount of time because she's been writing the novel in her head all that time. I haven't been writing it in my head. I don't have specific words and phrases so much. Sometimes I will have a word or a phrase or especially a title that I'll like, but I definitely have been thinking through the situations and the characters. And so when I start, I have very little doubt in my head as to what these people look like and what they sound like. And there aren't too many surprises when we start working our way down the page.
So do you write little character descriptions, or does that just kind of something you sit around and think about and
I think it through. I mean, one thing I do work on with students is writing character profiles and descriptions, and sometimes I do that, but usually only if I'm stumped. I mean, the kind of the only programmatic thing that I do with my writing, I otherwise just kind of sit down and spill, which is a very anarchic of me, but seems to work. But where I start to get organized, or at least kind of professionalize the work, I guess, is that after I've written a big first draft or something that feels like a coherent whole, I then go back and I outline it. And for procrastination purposes, I also I use a Microsoft Excel spreadsheet.
But
what it does allow me to do it, it allows me to see how many pages I have spent in each scene or chapter, and I'll kind of make notes as to I graph it scene by scene, and so that I know, you know. And then when I look it all over, it becomes immediately apparent if I have given, you know, this character 50 pages all to themselves, and I've given this other important character only 10, or if I've only ever let, you know, scenes in one part of the book, they were only spanning about 2 or 3 pages, and then in another part of the book, they're seeming to take 10 pages, then I'll have a certain sense of what the rhythm looks like. And I actually find it very helpful. But I, like I said, I only find it helpful after I've gotten all the material out there. I don't think I could work from an outline in the beginning because that'd be too much structure. But once I'm midway through it, I definitely do that outline, and then it becomes a huge help for me.
And then you kind of look at the structure and the rhythm of the novel and shift it based on what you see in your outline.
Exactly. I mean, I'm a big believer or a big attempter of trying to enforce rhythm in my writing. And so I definitely, you know, I like to have a large scene surrounded by a couple preparatory scenes, almost some sort of syncopated rhythm so that the reader, I think, kind of expects that as well. They want to have, it's a familiar device. I mean, you know, especially in a short story, there'll often be the opening gambit and then the longer middle and then a quick hit at the end. And so I'm often trying to structure chapters the same way, where it'll be a 2-page scene, 3-page scene, and then we'll break into a longer scene where instead of we'll stop with the elegant summary and we'll break into, you know, really spend some time, slow the camera work down so you're really focused on these characters.
Well, that's interesting. Liam, let's close by hearing what you're reading, what books you're paying attention to, and since you're talking about rhythm, maybe what music you're listening to.
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I've been reading Name All the Animals, which is a memoir by Alison Smith, which came out a couple years ago. It was very popular, and I really just loved. And since All Saints and the Cloud Atlas, for that matter, are fairly have books that are very interested in Catholicism, Name All the Animals has a real interest in that as well. I've also been reading The Inheritance of Loss by Kiran Desai. These are also books that came out a couple of years ago, and I think this is the writing teacher's life. We're always playing catch-up with books. We haven't quite gotten to, you know, and that we want to get to right now. One of the things I'm doing with my students, my grad students this upcoming semester, is a course called Crossing Borders, Crossing Genres, and so we're kind of reading some interesting genre-crossing novels from around the world. So we're going to be reading Jeanette Winterson's Passion and this book that my father sent me from Spain called Captain Alatriste. I think I'm saying that correctly. And then some Haruki Murakami. And then because there's this really interesting article in The Atlantic this month about a best-selling author named Harlan Coben, I decided I would read some of him and see what that was all up with. But I haven't quite come up with it. And then the last thing I've been meaning to do this for a long time, but I have come to know my neighbors on the bookshelf at libraries and bookstores. I'm always between Hortense Kalischer and Italo Calvino. In fact, they're usually there even when I'm not. And so we go from C-A-L-I to C-A-L-V. And I thought, I had read Italo Calvino, but I hadn't read Hortense Kalischer, and I'm reading the modern library edition of her novellas, and I just love it. And so I'm thinking of writing an essay reintroducing her. And let's see, and the music to go with it right now? I don't know. I'm listening to everything. I love this new, not that new, but Good Night from this kind of new ska band, Hot, Hot Heat. And then at the other end of the rainbow, Josh Ritter. It's got a new album out. I listen to KNBA, a radio station out of Anchorage, Alaska.
Really?
They are the ones who turn me on to all my new music. So
that's you get that on your computer?
Yes. I have to say I listen to more internet radio than anything else. I listened to KMBA in Alaska and then Nathan Hale High School in Seattle, Washington for my dance music. and then, of course, I listened to WWM here in Milwaukee because they're my hometown station, and they keep me up to date as well. So.
Oh, that's great. Well, now we have a lot of books to look for and a lot of new music. Thanks so much, Liam. This has been great.
You are very welcome. It was great to talk with you.
Great. This has been another edition of Always Right with Rochelle, the Right Now Coach. You can find a link to Liam's website and his books at my website, rightnowcoach.com. Thanks for tuning in, and remember to always write.